Broadcasting live from the Business Radio X studios in Atlanta, Georgia, it's time for Atlanta Business Radio, spotlighting the city's best businesses and the people who lead them.
All right, this is Lee Cantor here with Stone Payton, another episode of Atlanta Business Radio. Welcome, Stone.
Well, thanks for having me again, man. This is going to be a fun episode, but I got to ask you before we get started, because we're coming to the close of the week, the first full work week, it feels like. It feels like things are just now getting in the groove. But I need some movie recommendations, because we've saved our pennies. The whole family is going to the theater this weekend. What should we be seeing?
Well, in your family, I would think they would like Les Mis.
They would. Next option.
And I think you would like, I believe, Zero Dark Thirty is
Zero
out this week.
Affleck. Affleck. Yeah. No, that's not
Argo.
Him. Argo. See, this is why I have to ask
it's
you for
Zero Dark Thirty is the Ben Laden, where they got Ben Laden.
Okay. And then we've got Academy Award nominations. You didn't know this was going to be the cinema show,
no,
did you?
I'm
listening to NPR on the way in. This is how I educate myself.
We steal NPR. What they talk about earlier, we talk about a little later.
Exactly. So isn't this Zero Dark Thirty and all that, isn't it going to be up for the nomination?
Yes.
Expected to be or
whatever?
Expected
to be.
All right. We can quit doing the movie show if you want.
Whatever you'd like.
All right. No, this is going to be a great show. We've got a studio full. We have on Atlanta Business Radio this morning some folks from the Greater Atlanta Chapter of the Association of Fundraising Professionals. We're going to get a chance to visit with Jamie Tobias, Miriam Lewis, and I'm going to introduce first to give us a little bit of an overview of the association mission and purpose. Please welcome, I think, back to the Business Radio X microphone, right?
She's a regular.
Yeah. Please welcome Lisa Kennedy with the Bobby Dodd Institute. Welcome to the show, Lisa.
Well, thanks. We're delighted to be here this morning. Thanks for inviting us.
Yeah, we're glad to have you back. So give us a little thumbnail sketch, if you would, mission, purpose, what this association is up to and trying to do for folks.
Well, the Greater Atlanta Chapter of the Association of Fundraising Professionals is a local chapter of an international organization of people who work for nonprofits whose job is to generate resources for nonprofits so that they can deliver their programs and services in the community. And so what we do at the local level is provide continuing education opportunities to nonprofit professionals so that they can raise money in the most effective way and the most ethical way.
Right.
To make sure that the way that we work with donors is very clear and transparent, and that we help fundraisers understand how to work with donors and to make sure that donors' intent is fulfilled when they support nonprofits.
Now, is the people who work for nonprofits, are there a lot of nonprofits here in Atlanta? Is there a lot of members for this association?
Our association, our chapter, has about 400 members, and that includes all types of nonprofits throughout the community. Piedmont Healthcare, where Jamie works, and Quality Care for Children, where Miriam works, and Bobby Dodd Institute, and human services organizations, arts organizations, but we all come together in our shared commitment to promoting philanthropy in the community.
Now, would it drill down as low as like a Girl Scout troop or, like a kids booster club? Is that included in this? Like, could those people be members as well?
Well, we would definitely encourage people associated with troops and community organizations to participate in our chapter. And
there's stuff for them to learn, right?
Absolutely. Fundraising tactics that are most effective and the commitment to ethics, all of those things. Our members typically come from 501c3 nonprofit organizations as opposed to political fundraising.
Right, so it's not the political people by and large.
Right.
This profession just absolutely fascinates me, because I'm trying to put myself in the shoes of the professional that's going out and they're meeting with people or organizations who have money. And contrary to popular opinion in some sectors, people and organizations with money do want to give it and give it in a responsible way. But I can't imagine what it must be like to have that conversation. There's so many good causes out there. I got a ton of questions. My first, what prompted you to even get in this world?
Well, I think like a lot of people who work in the nonprofit sector, I was drawn to it based on a commitment to wanting to help improve the community and make sure that the services are there for people who need them. And then once you are inside the nonprofits and the nonprofit community, resources are really the most important element in fulfilling your mission. Without money, you can't deliver your mission.
So, Miriam, how did you get into this racket?
Well, my mother...
Maybe I shouldn't call it racket.
It can be something. I actually was always drawn to the nonprofit sector, but after getting involved with a few organizations, it became clear to me early on that I was not a social worker. Those are angels, and I am not that. I can't do that hard work. Excuse me. And so I realized early that there needed to be another role, and I actually had the opportunity to work with a fundraising consulting firm, and that was when I got introduced to fundraising and the unique role it plays in helping nonprofits move forward.
So you wanted to be in a profession that you were helping others, so you found a place within that that matched your skills and your interests?
Exactly.
But this has got to be, at least to some degree, different than a traditional sales or marketing role, but yet I would think some of those skills would come into play. I got Jamie over here nodding his head up and down. Jamie, weigh in on this thing. Tell us a little bit about that actual role of going out and securing funds for an organization.
Sure. The powerful story, it is like going out and selling something. But when you really get to talk to the donor and engage the donor and find out where their passion is, mm-hmm. and find out it's not always just about keeping an organization running. Sometimes it's about making a gift that transforms an organization or can do something for the community that brings it up to a different level. We all think of Bernie Marcus and what he's done with a lot of his philanthropic giving in the city. The aquarium comes to mind. The Marcus Autism Center, he just gave a big gift to the organization I work for to start a heart valve replacement program in Atlanta, which would be, I think we're one of five hospitals in the country that can do it. So it's.
Were you involved in that, of getting that going?
I work more in what we call sustained giving or annual giving. So mm-hmm. I work on the people that are making gifts year over year, usually smaller than $22.2 million. it'd be nice to have one person write that check every year. But
that's kind of an anomaly, right, when somebody does something huge like that?
Yes. It's usually what we call a transformative gift. It's usually out there to make, again, not to just pay for the normal everyday in and out that's already happening. It's to transform and take something to the next level or bring a new program into the fold.
So it would be powerful enough if you guys and some of your colleagues just got together for coffee now and then, exchange some ideas, but you've really got this structured organization providing continuing education, sharing best practices. Speak a little bit more to that, to the kinds of education classes, courses that you offer, and how that works.
Well, we offer chapter meetings every month where we typically have some sort of professional come in and talk with us about issues surrounding fundraising. It could be someone focusing on strategic planning, mm-hmm. or it could be a representative of a corporation or a foundation who wants to talk with us about what their particular interests are.
Right.
We offer classes, workshops on how to write effective proposals, how to run an annual campaign, as Jamie was talking about. So those types of programs. We also work a great deal in promoting philanthropy in the community.
Just like in general. Because I would think there would be a lot of opportunities, because there's a lot of people in Atlanta that have some wealth and have successful companies, and maybe is there a place for them to learn about how to get into this and how to give back to the community and start their own foundation or things like that? Is that part of the mission as well?
Well, our mission is really to educate fundraisers and to promote philanthropy. We host an event every year, National Philanthropy Day Luncheon, where we honor a philanthropist of the year and a volunteer fundraiser of the year. There are other organizations in the community, for example, the Foundation Center or the Community Foundation, that work more directly with funders to help them make decisions about their giving.
So I want to hear about this code of ethics, because I understand that's a big deal in your world, and I can understand why. Is there share with us, if you, Jamie, maybe you could share something about the code of ethics, and the other two weigh in, if you will. Tell us about this code of ethics.
Really, it's just our giving principle or our guiding principles for our job to make sure that we are adhering to ethical practices when fundraising. If you listen to NPR this morning, you might have heard that
I'm sending them a bill.
The Ray Charles Foundation had made a gift to a college in South Georgia and to build a music school, and they weren't able to fulfill that obligation, and they had to give the money back to the foundation.
Oh,
it's
wow.
a perfect example.
Does that happen a lot?
Yeah, Garth Brooks. It seems to be musicians, but Garth Brooks also in Oklahoma gave some money to a hospital to build a cancer wing for in honor of his mother who died of cancer, and they too did not fulfill it. And there was a big legal battle over that. So this is just our guiding principles to make sure that we're adhering to donor intent, that we're following a guide of ethics, so that we're not hurting our profession and for the people behind us to go around and continue the mission of these organizations.
Now, in this kind of a down economy, now it seems to be picking back up a little bit, but in the last few years where it was kind of a down economy, how did that impact your fundraising? Was that a challenge, a more challenging time last few years?
It definitely was challenging. we saw that giving definitely was dipped in areas, especially around certain things, foundations that give to other to nonprofits when most of that's kind of relative on the stock market and the returns and gains. So we saw a lot of a huge dip in foundation giving to nonprofits. And individual giving kind of would slow down.
Now, is this where really I would think that an association like the Association of Fundraising Professionals would really have a lot of value, because now you can learn the best practices from everybody and see what's working, what's not, and really kind of do the best you can under difficult times.
Sure.
And it would be a great resource. Is that what happened during that time?
Definitely. Well, it was also a little bit of therapy, I think, for all of us to come together and complain and commiserate. But I think also technology has changed so much and so quickly, it helps us stay on top of new trends, which is another way for us to, as trends change, we have to be ahead of the learning curve there and be ready to try new things and take risks. So it helps to have an organization like this where we have people who we can learn new ideas from and collaborate and share what practices work for some people. You would think we'd be all competitive. We're all scrambling for the same money, but we're not, because usually donors float to different causes and or have multiple causes.
Right.
So it's a great way to collaborate and share ideas.
And you're tied into a larger national organization, right?
International
organization. And so do you get to have some connection with them and some communication with them? How does that work?
We do. We work closely with International just to support the programs that we're offering to the Atlanta community, and also they have an international conference, but we are definitely an affiliate of them, and a lot of the resources that we offer to members comes directly through International. There's a web portal that has a great deal of information in terms of samples and best practices, ways to connect with other members and get information that you need. Kind of if you're new to the profession, you can hit the ground running and find out about what else is going on in the community and nationally, not just where you are. So we definitely work closely with International to provide the support that we do to the community in Atlanta.
Now, Miriam, part of your role is in the diversity, area of diversity?
Yes, it is.
So how does that take place in an organization like this?
Well, one of the things that my role does is to try to enhance the diversity of AFP here in Atlanta. And Atlanta's actually done a very good job of that. We've been recognized nationally. We won the Charles Stevens Award a few years ago. And also, we continue to get the Friends of Diversity Award every year. And what that means is that we are working to actively involve fundraisers of all different ethnicities and backgrounds.
We need more short people raising.
Is that what
you're saying? Exactly.
They're underrepresented.
Exactly. And what else that means is that we're working to engage diverse donors as well and help our members reach out appropriately to donors of different backgrounds, because it's a global community now. And so donors and philanthropists, they all look different. And so you need to make sure that you're connecting with people in a way that's meaningful for them. And a lot of times that just takes education. And so that is what our role is in terms of diversity.
Now, culturally, do different cultures do philanthropy differently?
Absolutely.
Really? So
absolutely.
Can you educate me a little bit about that?
Let's see. One of the things I think that's different, well, let's go back to one of the basic tenets of fundraising. One of the basic tenets is that it's about relationship, and people give to people.
Right.
And so building a relationship starts with connecting with a person, and that is where you see the difference with diversity the strongest. If you cannot connect meaningfully with a person because what they consider respectful is different from what you consider respectful
right.
in terms of asking for money, then you're not going to get the gift. So there are some communities and some ethnicities where it would be inappropriate to ask for a very specific amount in a very direct way.
Huh.
Whereas for here in America, we have a very established tradition of giving. And so everyone kind of anticipates that you're going to get asked and you're going to get asked for a specific amount, and it's not offensive. It helps you plan, and you know you're ready for that. And there are other communities where there's more of a suggested giving, or there's an anticipation of a percentage that you'll give without necessarily going into the numbers, just kind of accepted that everyone's going to give at least 10% of this amount of this portion of their income. And so those are the kind of intricacies that we try to help people negotiate. And it's difficult because as Atlanta continues to get more diverse and as philanthropy is beginning to really diversify in terms of the people who are giving, that is always going to be something that we try to be on the forefront of, teaching people how to connect with donors in a way that will maximize the gift but also maximize their relationship with the cause, which is what we do. I kind of see us as conduits. We're kind of the pass-through. We facilitate what people want to do. I take them from – I'm the background. So in the end, there's a donor that wants to support a cause, not necessarily an organization. They want to solve a problem, and I help them decide where they're going to focus their money to best solve that problem.
Now, Lisa, you past president?
Yes.
Is that right? Man, you must have just been over the moon when you came across Miriam.
It was a very happy new year for me, yes.
You know, a dozen more like her, huh?
Right.
Now, that's, you could just hear the passion and the sincerity
right. In
all three as we're having this conversation. I got to tell you, though, it surprised me a little bit, Jamie. I think you're the one that mentioned it earlier in the conversation, that it's not that competitive, that you're not really competing with each other, and your rationalization made sense. You said because donors tend to kind of gravitate to a certain cause. But I still want to talk to the past president about creating a culture within the association of collaboration. That must be a great deal of work, very rewarding when it happens, but let's talk about strategies and tactics to actually make that happen.
Well, that's a really good question, because
it really was a good question.
Fundraising tends to, and the nonprofit community in general tends to attract very driven people, very committed people, a lot of Type A personalities. So there are challenges inherent in building that collaboration when you have so many committed, driven people working together. But I think the one thing that connects everyone is a shared commitment to making Atlanta a stronger community and to meeting the needs of people who are underserved in the community and need opportunities to advance. So that's been a really important process. And we really focus on our shared values, our shared commitment to the community, and that tends to really galvanize us in our work.
Now, since this is an international association, is America kind of an anomaly in that a lot of our giving seems to happen from individuals and corporations and companies, and in other countries it's like a kind of a government gives to the community, and we're more of a bubble up from the grassroots? Do you see that internationally?
Well, we definitely started the trend of philanthropy. It's Western, it's ours, and that is something that's just starting to grow. Well, it has been for several years, but it's something that kind of started here in America, the tradition of giving, and that people give, and it started
way
back
with
the
individuals,
Carnegie.
Right?
We give as individuals, and that's the biggest percentage, is 70 5%, 80% individuals that give.
It's ingrained in American culture. If you look back as far as George Washington giving land to start schools, I mean, right. it is an American culture.
And that's different because in other countries, it's not that way.
Well, and I'm going to submit, I personally don't believe it's driven by the tax break. That's not what it is.
If you actually talk to some of the bigger donors out there, they will say it is not driven by the tax. It's driven by the passion and the... There is a the Wall Street Journal did an article recently about how it is kind of almost like a status thing of how much you can give and what kind of difference you can make with your philanthropic dollars. So
right, I saw that somebody was trying to get an initiative out there. I don't know if they were successful or not, but to do like they have the Forbes whatever 500, but they were trying to do that same thing with the who gives the most kind of thing. And just to encourage that, like from the super wealthy people to put that on the forefront of what they're being judged as.
But we're not always talking, I mean, everybody looks towards that big gift and those big givers. But I think what we're trying to ingrain, too, is that it's a responsibility from top to bottom, no matter how much you give, is to give back and promote these organizations. We have a program that we collaborate with the Kiwanis here in Atlanta called Philanthropy in the Classroom. And we go into second and third grade classes and teach them the importance of volunteering and giving back to the community. And last year we were in 15 classes promoting this this idea. And it was just a lot of fun to go back and teach how volunteering and just giving back is so important. And the kids got it at that young age. So
now is that... And that seems like a really worthy cause to be able to get kids involved and just make it part
that
of their lifestyle.
Yeah.
You know, if they just think that this is what I do every week is I give back or I volunteer so many hours, then they wouldn't know any different.
Right.
I would encourage more of it.
Right. No, I think
that's a great program.
More schools are doing more volunteer, and I think we...
So did you actually go in the classroom?
And I did.
So what was that like?
We read a story that talked about how volunteering and doing something good benefited the whole local community. And then we talked about how things that they've done that could be considered giving back or philanthropy. We actually defined the word philanthropy for them and made them try and pronounce it. I have trouble at times, so... But it was a lot of fun. They were really engaged, and we had them draw pictures to show examples of philanthropy.
But do you actually go out and do something? Was there an opportunity for them to actually volunteer for things?
That is something we're looking to incorporate.
That'd be great if you can take it to that level.
We had one class that did take on a project after the lesson.
Uh-huh.
The schools are more engaged with volunteering, and they have some examples. There's community gardens.
Right, there's volunteering clubs, I think, in some high schools.
Exactly.
Right.
So they're getting more and more engaged at a younger level. This program kind of helps reinforce those things. And they're talking about donating clothes to organizations, winter coats, and there's the Pennywise thing where everybody donates their pennies to a homeless shelter and all that. So the school's already getting engaged. So it helps that we're reinforcing that.
That is fantastic, and it underscores a point that you made earlier in the conversation where donors gravitate to a certain type of cause or certain group. For me, and I can tell the world, and they already know it, Lee, as well, youth is just one of those places. If I'm going to give money, that's a place that I'm going to be quicker to try to make a difference. So the minute you talked about that program, I'm really perking up. And that must, for some people... That might be restoring nature or something. They might perk up just as much, for saving a parkland or something.
And that's why it's more collaborative than competitive, I would imagine, because people are going to gravitate to the causes that they just individually are passionate about.
Yeah.
That's great. So I'm going to, it's partly my show, so I'm going to take a minute of it and share a personal experience. This Christmas, my two girls, one's in college, one's in high school, what I got from them, and it made me cry like a girl right there in front of everybody Christmas morning. What they got for me was in an envelope, was just a little note that they had given some money to an organization rather than buy me a gift. And I'll tell you, I'd rather have that than anything. Just so proud as a father. That was, except that I did cry like a little schoolgirl. But but no, it's a great feeling, and it's it must be so rewarding to be a part of creating those feelings and creating those kinds of results every day.
Sure.
So I want to dive into each of the respective organizations, and let's start with you, Lisa. Let's talk a little bit about the Bobby Dodd Institute mission, purpose. What's going on over there?
Well, at Bobby Dodd Institute, our mission is to empower people with disabilities, and we do that by providing job training and permanent employment opportunities for people with disabilities, and that could be any type of disability that poses a barrier to entering the workforce. Mm-hmm. It could be a chronic illness or a physical disability or a cognitive disability. And we, in addition to providing job training, we also run a wide range of social enterprises that create permanent jobs for people.
Right. That's what I love about your organization. When they were having trouble finding the jobs for these people, they said, well, we're going to come up with businesses so we can make jobs for these people. So they grew their own jobs to serve their people.
That's
even
outstanding.
More. Yeah, no, it's fantastic.
We run a janitorial business where we clean commercial office space, government office space. We also have a grounds maintenance business. We operate call centers. We have a call center in Bobby Dodd Institute in our facility at Marietta Boulevard that employs veterans and veterans with disabilities, and that is an AT&T call center, and we are honoring AT&T as our employer of the year this year at Breakfast with Champions on March 14th for their shared commitment to our mission.
So when you're not being a rock star on the radio and filling up the airwaves with all this good information, what is your day like? What's your day-to-day work like?
Well, It involves talking with our current and donors and prospective donors about where their interests lie in terms of the work that we're doing. Also, working very closely with the staff at Bobby Dodd Institute to learn about the impact of our programs in order to be able to share that with donors.
So you want to kind of show that where their money's, like the impact it's making, not only just where their financial investment is going and the impact that those dollars are making.
Absolutely. To be able to report in an effective way about what our needs are and the impact that those investments are having. That those are really the most important things that I do every day.
Well, before we ask Miriam about her organization, I'd like to get, actually I'm going to ask each of you to do this, get one tip from each of you that you might have to offer someone considering a career in this field, in the fundraising field. What's a tip or a lesson that you might share with them?
I would really recommend that people look towards or look to work with and for organizations that you would support philanthropically yourself, that you have a personal investment and commitment to that mission.
So it's all aligned.
Absolutely. So that you can act on that conviction every day and be a part of it. It's very difficult to ask someone to support something that you are
not
personally supportive.
Well, thank you. That's very interesting. Right. You already knew more about the Bobby Dodd Institute. You've talked about them before.
Yeah. And we've had Lisa on. And if somebody wants to learn more, is there a website?
Yes, our website is bobbydodd.org.
All right. And I want to ask Miriam, too, but I got to find out CFRE. This is on the business card, so it must mean something.
CFRE is a certification. It's Certified Fundraising Executive.
Uh-huh. And if you want to get credentialed like this, you better hang out over at the Association for Fundraising Professionals.
Exactly. That is one place to get the training. But it's actually a separate organization, and you have to be in the profession for 5 years, and you have to demonstrate service, and you also have to take a lovely standardized test and pass it.
Okay, so let's get the scoop, though, on quality care for children. Tell us a little bit about this outfit.
Well, Quality Care for Children is a statewide organization that is working to increase the quality of early childhood education. And what that looks like is we work with parents in terms of helping them find quality child care and helping them understand what high-quality child care looks like. And we also work with organizations, child care organizations, to increase their quality. And that looks like helping them teachers get their child development associate, helping teachers rearrange the classroom so that it's more beneficial to the students. So we go directly out and provide technical assistance to do that. And those are our two primary prongs just to try to advance early childhood education.
Now, what age range is that?
Early childhood goes from 0 to 5.
So it's before they get into the, like, kindergarten?
Exactly. Right. We go through pre-K.
And so what's next for you guys? You got some events coming up or things you're focusing on?
We do. This year we'll be doing our annual event in April, on April 25th. It's El Dia de los Niños, and it's that means Day of the Young Child. And it really is just an event that helps us celebrate young children in Georgia and bring together our supporters to talk about what new things are on the horizon. Our big thing for this year is that we're actually revamping our 877 All Georgia Kids website and portal. And what that does, anyone can go online and find quality child care in their neighborhood. It's very useful. A lot of times people just don't know where to look or what quality programs are around them. And so that's how we help facilitate. So that's our big thing for this year.
Now, is there a shortage of quality care for children?
There actually is. There is, in terms of high quality care. And what we try to do is help people become aware of where they can go to find high quality care and what that looks like. And sometimes that doesn't always look like the prettiest center that you'll see from the outside. It has to do with the ratio in terms of teachers and students. It has to do with what types of interaction the students are having with their children when they're there. And so by understanding what quality looks like, we hope that we can help parents look for something a bit deeper than just which building is the shiniest and prettiest when they go by for the tour.
Now, the impact of this care, though, on a child, like, it dramatically impacts their future skills and education? Is that accurate?
It does. Over 90% of a child's brain is formed before the age of five. And so what we know now is that if we work to increase the quality of early childhood education, we can actually directly impact graduation rates for these students. Because if they start off with a high-quality early childhood education, then they start pre-K, they start kindergarten ready to learn, and they start on track. If they enter first grade and they're behind, then the rest of their career is spent trying to help catch them up. And so we actually, for all of the work that is done in early childhood education, you save $7 in remedial education later on in life. So it's,
wow.
It's
now,
an
isn't there,
like,
I thought I read some, like, really amazing stat, like, some kids don't read any books, and then they have a certain level of success, and then the ones that read more, and the amount of books they read are, like, dramatically different between the people with poor, like, care at that level and the people that are that have more.
I'm thinking about that. I know that I have read that there is a difference in the number of words spoken for children who are from a low-income community where they are not. It's the number of words the child speaks. And the number of words in their vocabulary directly impacts their reading ability and how easy reading is for them.
Don't fall for it, Miriam. He's setting you up to buy his book. You're suggesting that if they read the more active kids' book.
No. But no, I thought it was something dramatic. What about the vocabulary part? Was that dramatic?
Like the it is dramatic. It is a huge difference. Like there's a huge discrepancy in the number of words that children can speak if they're in a higher quality early childhood education program versus if they are in a low quality education program, and that directly impacts their literacy later on because speaking words is the first way you learn how to read.
That was my point.
So let's leave our listeners with a tip, either about the profession or maybe getting the most out of their relationship with the Association for Fundraising Professionals.
Well, my first tip is for everyone to call Lisa because she knows everything and everyone.
Wow.
Really, the reason what I am going to say is it's about people. It's about learning as much as you can and connecting with a person specifically, which is why I'm picking on Lisa. But meeting someone early in the association, joining the association, and making a connection is really how you begin to learn. There's a lot of formalized learning, but there's a lot of intricacies in terms of fundraising that you just, until you're in that situation that day, you don't really know necessarily what to do or how to handle it. And to have someone, you can pick up the phone and call and say, okay, this is new. What do you think? Let's talk about it. It was someone that you know also adheres to the same code of ethics as you. It makes it that much easier. So I would say seek out professional learning opportunities, but then also find a mentor, someone that can help guide you and point you in the right direction. And Lisa's always available.
And let's get some coordinates for you, email, website, that kind of thing.
My email is Mariam.Lewis, which is a little difficult, MARYUM.Lewis@QualityCareForChildren, all spelled out, it's very long, .org. And our website is www.qualitycareforchildren.org.
and the website for getting more short people involved in fundraising, or is that not up yet?
It is part of our AFP Atlanta website. There's information on diversity and getting all kinds involved, because it takes all kinds.
That's right. We want everybody. We want everybody. Okay, Jamie, tell us about Piedmont Healthcare Foundation and justify your role. No, tell us what you do over there.
Well, most people think Piedmont, and they think the hospital that sits in Buckhead.
Right.
And actually, we're a five-hospital system. We have a hospital in Henry, Fayette, and Noonan, as well as one in Jasper. We also have a heart institute that stretches across the state, east, west, north, south, into North Carolina. We have an offices. We also have a transplant institute that goes as far south, all the way down to Savannah, Macon, which we do transplants, primarily liver and kidney, but we've doing some more heart transplants. That was new for us this year. And we have a cancer wellness program, which is really one of its only kind in Atlanta, and it is primarily focused on wellness while you're going through cancer treatments, when you have a diagnosis. So East meets West, there's acupuncturists, there's meditation, there's yoga, and all this is a service that we provide for free for anybody with a cancer diagnosis, whether you go to a Piedmont doctor or not. And all of that is provided through philanthropy. That program is 100% funded through donated dollars.
So the foundation kind of sits... It's integrated as part of it, but it kind of sits separately.
We are separate. Right? We're considered an entity under the overarching umbrella, but we do sit separate from the business side as itself. And what we are out to do is raise funds for things that are not part of the business model, and things that we can go out and do extra and provide services. Whether it's there's some funds out there for a transplant for people who are going through getting a transplant to help them with the assistance. It's a very expensive procedure, so to help them with that. We have an aging care program that helps really educate the caregivers when someone, a loved one, is going through dementia or Alzheimer's, to help them through that process. There's counseling groups and all that. And again, that's another program that's free because of donated dollars from individuals. We also have a diabetes resource center, which is for people with diagnosis of diabetes. It's free. It's more education. We try and do a lot of patient education. Mm-hmm. We try and find money for financing when possible, but it's more about education and keeping people healthy. And as we go through healthcare reform, that's a huge thing, because part of the new healthcare reform is keeping people from getting readmitted back to the hospitals. It saves us money as well. So it's a win-win model. Primarily, yeah, we're looking at patient education and advocacy through the foundation. But sometimes we buy equipment. We're going to start a heart valve program that's underway. We have the only blood cord donation program in the state that's free. And that's when a baby is born, the umbilical cord is donated. And it's donated for research, and they do kind of genetic testing and all that. That's through Cleveland Clinic. That we just started that earlier this year. So, and that was through a foundation grant.
I got to say, that's a relatively easy thing for me to give up. Yeah, the umbilical cord from right.
Some people want to keep it.
I would have done that. If you'd have called me, I would have done that.
It should be a little box you check.
Right. Well, there are other hospitals that do allow you to donate it, but you have to pay to donate it, because there's a lot of procedures about how it's preserved and kept and shipped. Sure. So this foundation provided us the resources.
The tool to make it just simpler.
To make it happen and not have to charge the patient.
Yeah, that's a great idea.
That's outstanding.
And so the website?
We're PiedmontPhilanthropy.org.
And you're going to get your tip from him?
Absolutely. He's had like the 20 minutes to prepare the tip. It ought to be the best of the bunch. No, any counsel you might offer somebody. Yeah.
Listening. I think that it's important that you listen to what the donor has to say and really listen. A lot of times we go in with an idea of what we want to ask them to give.
Like what you need.
What we need. And there is an importance to have a plan, because sometimes they say, well, I want to donate I don't know, a piece of machinery that you don't really need, and you don't. Right. So you need to be able to be strategic, but you need to listen and hear where their passion is. So if I go in and I'm thinking about this new heart procedure we want, and that you hear them talk repeatedly about cancer, then you need to be ready to switch your focus and really listen to what the donor wants.
Well, it's certainly been an absolute delight listening to the three of you talk about the profession and what's going on.
Is there a website for the association?
Yeah, let's do that.
We are at afpatlanta.org.
afpatlanta.org. And that's for people in fundraising in any way except political, you said, right?
We would love to have anyone who's interested in helping their nonprofit learn to raise more money and be more effective come to our chapter meetings.
Good. And that's monthly?
We meet on the third Tuesday of every month, and we meet at the Seelig Center.
Oh, very nice. All right, this is Lee Cantor for Stone Payton. We will see you all next week on Atlanta Business Radio.